I was 20 when it happened. It was a dark autumn night on the banks of the River Elbe, the coal fires of Hamburg's stolid and crumbling tenements adding their chemical tang to the evening's damp mist. I'd been handed my match ticket as we left Feldstrasse U-Bahn station and then headed up the stairs in a one-way throng. Everyone around me was singing, stamping and letting fall emptied cans of Holsten. They rattled percussively on the walkways. Through the turnstiles with a creak, mumbled thanks, a drop of fag ash and half a ripped ticket pushed back. Then up the dozen steps and into the Nordkurve, just as Hans Albers' Auf der Reeperbahn started to splutter and crackle through the megaphone speakers fixed to the overhanging roof of the main stand and the stanchions. Smoke and steam rose from the crowd, thousands of shining eyes turning towards the dew-speckled field as kickoff grew near. Someone brought me a bratwurst, with a ripple of sweet mustard along its glistening top edge and a foaming beer in a plastic glass. Just then, the teams ran out, a roar went up, a floodlight failed, and everybody laughed. I laughed too, so loud I almost spat out some sausage. So this is football, I thought. And everything changed.
That was an extract from the brand new, wonderful book, Square Peg Round Ball, Football, TV and Me, by Ned Balting. Published by Bloomsbury, priced at £14.99, and available from the When Saturday Comes shop and other booksellers.
Come on, lads, it's time to kick off.
Welcome to When Saturday Comes, the half-decent podcast that strikes the ball through a forest of legs and beyond a hapless goalkeeper. I'm Daniel Gray, and joining me are When Saturday Comes magazine editor Andy Lyons and writer Harry Pearson. This is an online recording, given current restrictions, but hopefully it isn't too far away from the usual quality. Thanks to those who have joined the When Saturday Comes Supporters Club on Patreon so far. If you haven't, please have a look at patreon.com/whensaturdaycomes.
Harry, what gastronomic treasures are on the table this time?
Well, before I say anything, there's strange things going on in the town where I live because the Poundland has closed down, and then it's been announced that the Pound Stretcher is also closing down, and the local paper said that shoppers took to social media to voice their anger and disappointment. I don't know whether I'm angry or disappointed. At the moment, I just feel numb, but I expect that eventually the emotions will just come over me in a great wave. But anyway, I've taken the opportunity. I've been to Pound Stretcher while it's still there, and I've got two Jammy Dodgers, but not just ordinary Jammy Dodgers. I've got the Dinosaur Edition, which come with rawsome raspberry filling, and also the Unicorn Edition, which come with magical raspberry filling. And I'm going to have a comparative tasting afterwards and see if I can tell the difference between rawsome and magical. I expect my elderly taste buds won't really be up to that. But I've also got, as well, another special edition of Oreo cookies, and then a special Lady Gaga edition. And my daughter's back living with me at the moment. And when she saw them, she said, "Oh yeah, Lady Gaga, she used to be kind of chorizo, but I guess she's very vanilla flavoured now." Which I've no idea what that means, but in the unlikely event there are any young people listening to our podcast, they'll probably understand. And I noticed that on the side of the packet, there's a QR code, and it says, "Scan to unlock a playful experience." So if the podcast starts to flag, I'll do that. I wondered actually, Andy, if there might be a room for, with all these special editions, there could be a When Saturday Comes wagon wheel.
Yeah, unicorn flavour.
Sell by the dozen, I would imagine. Yeah.
I don't think I ever had one at a football game. I know they came to be associated with football. I remember seeing them in supermarkets, but I never actually bought one at a football ground.
I don't think I've ever seen them at a football ground. Like you say, just why they're associated with it, I don't know.
Yeah, it became the thing that everybody said you could get at football, wasn't it? Like Bovril, which admittedly was fairly widespread. Bovril and wagon wheel.
An unsavoury combination. Oh.
And for our self-allotted Middlesbrough segment, Harry, so that listeners can do something else for a minute or two, perhaps click on that QR code we could tweet.
With this unlock a playful experience.
Yeah.
With Lady Gaga.
Sad news last week that ex-Borough keeper Willie Wigham has died. Was there any truth in those stories that he used to take a drag on cigarettes offered to him by fans behind the goal, do you think?
I'm not sure. It was one of those things that I was going to say it was repeated so often that it must be true, but then you realise it was just repeated by one journalist after another who'd got it from reading another journalist's story. But I remember he was a big character, and when I first started going to Ayrton Park, it would be 1968. He was the first choice keeper, and he was quite a singular looking man, I think we'll say. And he put me in mind as a small boy of the Aquaphibians from Stingray. And it was said that every home on Teesside had a photograph of him above the mantelpiece, just to keep the kids away from the fire. Brian Bennison, my friend, said that he went to a game at Loftus Road in the late 60s, and he was in the home end. And when Willie Wigan came into the goal, the bloke standing near him said, "They say that people look like their pets. I wonder what that keeper feeds his rhinoceros on." But apart from that, he was a very good goalkeeper and very well liked. And he used to come to Borough games after he retired. He used to come to games and stand in the Holgate end. I think he worked as a security guard in Darlington. But also he'd played a lot of games for Falkirk as well, about 150 games for Falkirk. And he was working as a car mechanic at the time, and he used to come to training straight from work. And apparently other players remembered him because he wore a string vest and white scarf. A bit like Stan Ogden, I thought, from Coronation Street. And his career had begun at Shots Bon Accord, which is a fine name.
Yes, yeah, indeed. We had a plasterer who really looked like Willie Wigan, and I never plucked up the courage to say. And before I did manage to say anything to him, he was taken off the job by the gaffer because, in his words, he'd grown too fond of opening cans in the morning.
What, cans of condensed milk and stuff like that?
Must have been that, yeah.
Just anything, just random can opening.
Andy, any thrilling developments in lockdown London?
Well, before I mention those, of which there aren't any, I should say, an addition to the William Wigan thing, Dick Emery, a comedian who used to do lots of fairly broad characters on his comedy shows in the 70s, he used to do a character who was a vicar with protruding teeth. In each sketch, he'd be talking to someone whose name would sound funny when he said it with his sticky out teeth. And I distinctly remember one week that the person he was talking to was called William Wigan, because he'd say it like William Wigan. It looked funny with a guy saying it with his kind of his protruding teeth. So maybe the script writer was a Borough fan, possibly.
It's possible.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, in terms of London lockdown, there's absolutely nothing happening. So I had to look further afield for things to get interested in. I happened to be looking, as you do occasionally, at Italy's second division table, saw that Monza were doing well. Monza currently second. And this is something I knew because I looked into it once, that they're the team who spent the most seasons in the second division without ever playing in the first division in Italy. In England, it's Port Vale are the team who hold that record. But so I thought, oh, it'd be a nice story. They get promoted this season, first time ever. But then, as I subsequently discovered, Monza's owner now is Silvio Berlusconi, who sold Milan a few years ago, and now he's looking to get back into Serie A. So maybe it's not quite the nice story it might have seemed. It's going to be Berlusconi's sort of leap back into the football big time, unfortunately. Other football news, Swansea recently announced on social media they now have an official turmeric supplier. It's a company owned by Hal Robson Carnu. Turmeric's supposed to be good. It's supposed to be good for everything. I remember trying a drink containing turmeric once, and it was horrible. And I realise that's not a scientific assessment, but I'm not doing that. Maybe I just got a bad batch. I don't know. Also this week, a strong contender already for, I would say, the worst press releases we've received this year. There's a US sock manufacturer called Stance who've done a deal with Barcelona for what they describe as a three-sock drop. Basically, they're doing these red and blue socks, which they're launching at the big fanfare. And the quote from their press release says, "A collaboration with Barcelona, a club which celebrates on-pitch creativity like no other, was a no-brainer for us. We are proud to be partnering with a club which refuses to stand still. Barcelona's reputation as a creative hotspot where street art fuses with the world of skate and surf also appeared to Stance's values." Well, Barcelona are currently over £1 billion in debt, so they'll need to shift a few sets of these socks, I think. So good luck with that. Finally, Ian St. John died recently, in WC's first ever TV appearance was on St. Greaves, not in the studio, but on film. And he's one, you may already know this, one of only five players in league history whose surname begins with Saint, written as ST. The only player before him was a Wally St. Pierre, who played for West Ham in the 20s and 30s, but another three more recently, notably Sean St. Ledger, Ireland international defender who played mainly for Preston, but not been many Saints in English League football.
And that was the football news section.
It was fantastic. It was like the old WSC diary that people appealed to bring back.
That was entirely football news due to the absolute dearth of things happening to me, other than the fact that I had a leaked pipe repaired.
That could be the ants that could have caused that. That's their revenge, Andy. They know that you're killing them.
Yeah, they may have tried to sabotage.
I think they probably are. I think that's what they're doing. They're like ninja ants.
There was a leaked pipe under my sink, not part of my personal plumbing, I should actually emphasise.
And issue 408 of When Saturday Comes is out now, and as ever, the letters page is a brilliant read. Which letters did you enjoy in particular, Andy?
Well, a letter from John Smith, if that is his real name, who disputes a claim that had been made in a TV column recently that Phil Neville's great-great-grandfather could have been in the Crimean War. And he points out it could only be one of Phil's or Gary's great-great-great-great-grandfathers. He shows his working on this. I suppose Phil Neville himself could have confirmed this. There may be, you know, tales handed down in the Neville family of events at Sevastopol. Who knows? And another letter, Chris Roger, answering letter about meeting players in non-football settings, says that he's a Hearts fan and he's travelling back from they'd had a win over Dunfermline. He spotted a Hibs player, Martin McIntosh, standing behind him in the queue to use a cash machine. And Hibs had just lost 3-0 at Celtic. So he says, I worked up the courage to get in a sly dig by asking if the pizza box he was holding was comfort food. I think his response was the moment my childhood ended. He said, great day for me, mate. I wasn't playing.
And you, Harry?
Well, there was a letter about from a Sunderland fan, Gary Stout in Durham, about what they call the law of Akinbaye. I think we discussed this off air, because I'd written in my match of the month saying that Middlesbrough were... I said, if a team are looking to turn a corner, Borough are the side ever willing to provide the angle. And Gary disputes that, saying that Sunderland are that team and citing this law of Akinbaye. People would remember that Adi Akinbaye, I think he was signed for Leicester and then hadn't scored for, I don't know, you know, 3 years or something, and scored in the 61st minute to give Leicester a victory over Sunderland, again in the middle of a slump. So he's saying that they're the team. But I think that you said to me that Tom Hocking from When Saturday Comes believed that statistical evidence showed that the team to do that against was Sheffield Wednesday. So maybe there are many teams that have their equivalent of the law of Akinbaye. There's a very nice letter as well about, I talked about on the podcast about Graham Souness bringing him, when he was banned from the touchline as player manager, that he picked himself as a sub. And apparently Chris Lynham from Twickenham points out that Andy Hessenthaler did a similar thing when he was at Gillingham. And also there's a nice letter about the old teams named after industrial places. So it's like Yorkshire Copper Works. That's from David Willacy in St Albans, saying that there seems to be fewer of them now than there used to be. I particularly like the Leeds Industrial Cooperative Society. And I wondered if actually, because there used to be a lot of teams with the kind of church names, like Macclesfield Baptist Church and things like that. I wonder if they've faded away too.
I was entertained by further correspondence on dreams involving football people in the letters pages. The one I can recall most vividly involved me being about to play for Borough in an away match at Hillsborough for some reason. And I was in the changing rooms and I remember Robbie Musto saying the words, just play your usual game, to me. This was only a couple of years ago, so I'm not sure if it was a mid-30s beer belly, tired father me or an earlier version. But I was wondering if you two can recall any football-related dreams, or do you live by the wise rule of never boring people with such things, Andy?
Well, I often have dreams of playing football, at least of being in a team and not being able to kick the ball properly. So it comes to me sometimes and I can barely control it, or I take a swipe and I miss, or I can hardly move it forward a lot. I've had this one a few times and yet I'm still in the team each time. I don't get substituted or something. So maybe I'm the chairman's son or something, or maybe it's in an authoritarian state and I'm the generalissimo, I'm the strongman, the cordillo, you know. Hence, people keep passing to me even though I'm useless. Maybe the later on there'll be a scene in the boardroom where I'm presented with the Man of the Match award.
You're doing your best work off the ball.
Yeah, that's right. By killing people, possibly, in the case of expanding the story out in my state. No, I'd be a benign dictator. I wouldn't do things like that.
And Harry?
I did write a column because about this, actually. There's nothing that's happened to me that I haven't written a column about. Because my partner, Darren, says that I kick at night sometimes, as if I'm playing. She says, oh, you had a football dream last night where you're kicking, but I can't ever remember what the dreams were. I hope that they're football, that I'm not being attacked by snakes or something like that, really.
Maybe you're trying to kick the fascist dictator footballer Andy Lyons from When Saturday Comes.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe I'll turn up in Andy's dream. That'd be a bit strange. We don't want to do that. Yeah, if I do, don't tell me, Andy. I don't want to know.
Some of my people might need to have a word with you about that. You want to watch your step. That's all I'm prepared to say at this stage.
As mentioned, issue 408 of the magazine is out now. Tell us some more of the contents this time, Andy.
Well, the regular object lessons feature, which is by Jack Walton, writes about getting a programme from eBay of a game his granddad played in Canterbury City against Swindon FA Cup 1969. He gave it to his granddad at Christmas and his granddad then proceeded to show how the game went. He was marking a Swindon player, Dom Rogers, who's a winger. Granddad was a fullback. And he used a sprout as a ball, and he they had various things they had in Christmas crackers, a key ring and a hair clip from Christmas crackers to represent himself and Dom Rogers. But Dom Rogers scored the only goal late on after one of his granddad's teammates, who his granddad describes as a bleeding idiot, had handled the ball, 89th minute, I think. Richard Waft, who's a York City fan, the thing on York finally leaving Bootham Crescent and starting to play in the new ground, the construction of which was an extremely long process, including what Richard describes as the obligatory endangered newt discovery. There's also an auction of old fixtures and fittings at Bootham Crescent, but no one has yet snapped up the stainless steel gents urinals. So they're still available for someone who should need a talking point for your back garden or whatever, or for your living room, in fact. Mark Sanderson did a piece on commentators' notes, facts and figures about each player that commentators write down before games so they can work them into their commentary if they get a chance. Mark spoke to various commentators, including John Murray of the radio and TV's Peter Drury. And Peter Drury says he keeps all his match notes going back 27 years, which he's going to pass on to his sons. And Mark asked him what his advice would be to his sons, and he says, burn them. and that has actually led to a discussion on Twitter involving some commentators, John Roder and Steve Wilson. John keeps his notes for two seasons. Steve says his go straight into the recycling afterwards, so no sentiment there. Finally, also, Hugh Richards did get a Match of the Month feature. Southend, who've had a very grim couple of seasons, and are near the bottom of the League Two against Bolton, of course, who also have had a major crisis recently. The game settled by a bizarre goal where the ball looped up over Southend goalkeeper Mark Oxley, who knocked it back into play rather than letting it go over, and the Bolton player scored. And someone in the press box said, that's the sort of goal that gets you relegated. And Harry's column this time, which is on how players' regular tomfoolery is possibly being constrained a bit by COVID.
Tell us more, Harry.
Well, it's the thing that when footballers retire, the thing that they always say they miss most is the banter in the dressing room. And obviously a lot of players haven't been getting their banter, their daily banter. So I was wondering how they were doing that and how they would be doing that at home. But it's possibly Zoom banter. And I did actually have to say that in order to write the column, I did have to watch YouTube footage of Peter Taylor impersonating Norman Wisdom, which just shows the sacrifices I make for WSC. I did enjoy as well that there was a piece at the back of the When Saturday Comes, a regular season piece, which was about the Isthmian League. And it made me wonder is the Isthmian League the most difficult league to pronounce?
I feel like that, Harry, and I'm glad you took your turn in saying it, because Andy can pronounce it and proudly does on regular occasions.
Please say it, Andy, for me.
What they say,
Isthmian. Isthmian, yeah. Isthmian. I think it's one of those. It sounds like it's been invented to trip foreigners up. If for example, in the Second World War, German paratroopers disguised as nuns had come down, people would just have had to say, would just have to point at it and get them to say Isthmian. And I don't think they'd have been able to do it.
I think it'd only get worse if it got sponsored by ibuprofen. That's the one.
That's a trick, yes.
The ibuprofen Isthmian League.
Imagine if Dick Emery's big-toothed vicar had to say Isthmian.
God. He probably did in one of the other sketches. I may have blanked that out of my mind.
Ian Dowie featured in the season in brief page that you mentioned of the aforementioned league in the Went On to Greater Things segment at the bottom of the page. And it gave mention of him leaving non-league to become a professional player with Luton Town. And in a lovely coincidence, my stepmum was recently looking through some of her late dad's papers and found a newsletter from his and Dowie's old employer, British Aerospace, from that exact time. And in a story headlined Ian, spelt wrongly, quits DSE for LTFC, the newsletter tells how former development software engineer Ian, wrong again, Dowie, has left the company to join the select ranks of professional footballers in the Barclays League. And there's a quote from one Ray Cobbold, an ex-colleague. Ian, wrong again, used to come in every Monday and reenact how he had scored for his side on the previous Saturday. He would perform all sorts of Brazilian ball juggling skills with rolled up paper, plasticine, and even bunches of keys. You name it, he'd juggle it. So there you are, Ian Dowie, key juggler and office wag. That's an amazing image, doing kick-ups with keys, isn't it?
It's an amazing image of Ian Dowie with Brazilian ball skills, to be honest.
He certainly didn't bring any of those onto the football field. Then again, maybe he just wasn't asked to. He just did what was required.
Maybe he's one of those people where people said, you know, well, you know, he doesn't look so good, but if you saw him with some plastic, you give him a ball of plasticine, he's magic.
Pound a goal, draw it off time, £500 prize draw. Get your hats and scarves and pin badges. Your hats and scarves and pin badges. Get your hats and scarves and pin badges. Pin badges, hats, scarves. Hats and scarves and pin badges.
Programs!
Programs! Programs!
Subscribe to When Saturday Comes and you'll get every issue delivered direct to your door in 100% recyclable wrapping, which we used to call a paper envelope. You'll also save money on the shop price, receive discounts on books and t-shirts, and get free access to our complete digital archive. Sign up at shop.wsc.co.uk.
Jackpot tickets, pound a go, drawn at half time, £500, yours to take on tonight.
Right, I'm going to give the random topic generator a shove. Here we go. Bethlehem Steel FC, Jimmy Frizzle, corner flags that went on to greater things, and it's landed on miscarriages of justice. Ooh. Andy, what does that highly spontaneous subject bring to mind for you?
Well, interesting you should say Jimmy Frizzle there, Dan, whereas I would say Jimmy Frizzell.
I was wondering about that. I've never said that out loud, so it's good to have clarification.
I may not have done either, actually, until just now, but it felt quite good. I felt quite good saying it, I must say.
What about Jimmy Cyril?
Oh, Jimmy. No, he's Jimmy Cyril.
Well, it might come up on the random topic generator and we can debate that at length.
Well, we could certainly do something on how do you pronounce the, like a list of, say, 10 football people's names, and how do you pronounce each one, and see how many variations we would have.
Maybe the QR code on the chocolate bar leads to entertainment like that.
It probably is that, yeah. I imagine on Dynasty, if Jimmy Cyril had appeared on Dynasty, they would have pronounced it Jimmy Cyril.
They wouldn't have been able to understand what he was saying, though.
I don't know what scenario that would have involved, the scriptwriters of Dynasty.
But miscarriages of justice, however, Andy.
Oh, yes. Well, yeah. I'm glad you asked me that, Dan, actually. Now we're right back on topic. Well, first thing that occurs to me, really, is that Thierry Henry handball in the World Cup playoff between Ireland and France in 2010 that set up the winning goal for France, for William Gallas, made more annoying, I would imagine, for Ireland fans, or just in general, by the fact that Henry made a show of consoling an Ireland player at the end of the game. He sits down next to an Ireland player and does a kind of, hey, what can you do sort of thing. And I thought the player should have told him to get lost or words to that effect. Trinidad should probably have qualified for the 1974 World Cup. They're in the final round of qualifiers. That all the games were played in Haiti with Mexico and three other teams. And they missed out by qualification by 2 points. And in their game against Haiti, who were the hosts, they had 4 goals disallowed as they lost 2-1. And the referee from that game was from Honduras, and one of the linesmen who was from Canada was subsequently suspended by FIFA, but obviously there was no consolation to Trinidad because Haiti got through to the World Cup. So very strange goings on there. Didn't get as much coverage at the time as it would have done if it had been in Europe, because it involved CONCACAF, but it was very weird. Leeds in the Dom Revier, and not everyone's favourite team, but nonetheless, you'd have to concede they were hard done by at least a couple of seasons in a row, 70-71 and 71-72, when they missed out on the title to Arsenal and Derby, respectively, by a point in both times. In the first case, Leeds were at home to West Brom a few games before the end of the season. West Brom won 2-1, and the referee allowed play to go on when the West Brom player was clearly offside, and West Brom scored. That put them 2-0 up. Leeds got a goal back, but they won 2-1. There was a pitch invasion at the end. And Barry Davis on the commentary says over footage of Don Revie looking furious at the end of the game that he has every right to be angry. Barry Davis being very sympathetic towards the Leeds, feeling they've been hard done by the referee. In the following year, they had one final fixture to play. They were a point behind Derby, played all the matches. Leeds had a better goal difference, only needed a draw at Wolves. But they lost 2-1, and there was an incident in that game where a Wolves defender clearly handles the ball in the area, but the referee didn't give it. Then to complete a sort of hat-trick, the year after that, they got to the Cup Winners' Cup final, lost 1-0 to Milan. This was played in Salonika in Greece with a Greek referee called Christos Mikas, and he was suspended by UEFA and never did another international game after that match because he favoured Milan to such an extent. He sent off Norman Hunter for reacting to a bad challenge from behind, and was actually jeered off by the home crowd as a result of it. But again, suspending him after the event, no consolation to Leeds. Holland at the 78 World Cup. First, there's a gamesmanship by the Argentinian players before the start of the match, and they objected to one of the Dutch players, Randy van der Kerkhove, had a plaster cast on his arm, which he'd been playing with for a few games, and they decided to make an issue of it. And there's a so the start of the game was held up. One of the Dutch players, Johan Neeskens, who was playing for Barcelona, was translating between the Dutch and Argentinian players. And it's only when he said to the Argentinian players the Dutch players are going to walk off and refuse to play that Argentina relented and decided, oh, they better let van der Kerkhove carry on with the plaster cast. And of course, towards the end of that game, in normal time, Rob Rensenbrink of Holland hits the post with a shot that would have probably have won the World Cup for Holland. It was one all at the time. And it is a shame the Dutch team of that era didn't win anything, and they faced the extra obstacle of having to play the hosts, first West Germany and then Argentina in two successive World Cup finals. And also, as an Everton fan, I have to mention Clive Thomas. He refereed Everton-Liverpool FA Cup semi-final in 1977, disallowed what seemed a perfectly good goal by Everton's Brian Hamilton towards the end that would have put them 3-2 up. None of the Liverpool players were complaining about it. He later claimed at different times it was for offside or for handball, neither of which was the case. The game went to a replay, which Liverpool won. And there was a story of a Liverpool fan who was exasperated by one refereeing decision by Thomas in the replay, shouted, "Thomas, you've given us nothing," which actually drew laughter even from the other Liverpool fans around.
Harry?
Well, Andy mentions Barry Davis. I would think of him saying, "And the Italians have only themselves to blame because they will not learn." In 2002, after Italy were beaten by South Korea, the Italians had only themselves to blame, despite having had a perfectly good goal chalked off and Francesco Totti shown a red card for diving when he was clearly fouled. South Korea, you know, I've always been a big fan of theirs. I think they always came into tournaments as a minnow, but they did get past Spain in the round before Italy. Spain had not one goal disallowed, but two. You might even think of it was a conspiracy if you were that sort of person. I would also look at Scottish referee Les Mottram, famously disallowing a goal in Dundee United versus Partick Thistle. Paddy Connolly heads a ball into the net. It hits the goal frame, bounces back out. Clark, the Partick Thistle defender, actually catches the ball and hands it to the goalkeeper. And Les Mottram managed to miss the goal and the fact that it was and the penalty. He then went on to referee in the 1994 World Cup. This was in February 1993. He went on to referee in the 1994 World Cup, and then he went and served as a professional referee in the J-League in Japan. And I found an interview with him in 2002 by a Japanese magazine, and he was asked, "What is the future of football?" And he replied, "The survival of the biggest and richest clubs." So, a cheery thought. Also think of Graham Poll as well, and his 2006 World Cup and the three strikes and you're out incident with Josip Simenic of Croatia. Croatia were playing Australia. Simenic was shown three yellow cards before he was sent off. And Graham Poll later explained that Simenic was born and brought up in Canberra, and he said that he'd been confused by Simenic's Australian accent. I mean, I don't know, but the Croatian shirt's quite noticeable. You think he might have spotted that above the accent, but apparently not. Also, the famous incident in the Bundesliga in a game between Bayer Leverkusen and Hoffenheim, in which Felix Birch allowed a goal that actually a header from Stefan Kiesling that went in through the side netting, a hole in the side netting into the goal. And actually, if you watch the film, you can see Kiesling, after he's headed the ball and he sees it hit the side netting, he actually turns away in annoyance with himself for missing the chance. And then the next thing you know, the ball's in the net. And a lot of people say that Felix Birch, you know, you can't see it. It's very difficult to see it by the naked eye. But before games, the referee and their assistants make that big deal of checking all the nets, don't they? You're going around pulling all the nets. So what are they doing? Is that just for show? Because surely they should have spotted the hole when they were doing that. Yeah, there's a good goal that the Turkish referee in 1986, Ahmet Ake, who in a game between Ankara and Besiktas, there's a shot that goes in from one of the Ankara players, and he's standing on the edge of the six-yard box, and it hits him on the side of the head and goes into the goal. And of course, he gives the goal, which is perfectly reasonable because, of course, the referee counts as part of the field. So hitting the ref is just like the equivalent of hitting a divot. but it's not really a miscarriage of justice, except that at the end of the season, I think Galatasaray, it was about the fifth game of the season, and Ankara won the game 1-0. It was the only goal of the game. And at the end of the season, Galatasaray won the league title. Besiktas were runners-up and they were just 1 point behind. So if they got a 0-0 draw, I think they might have won the Turkish title. So they may see it as a miscarriage of justice, even though, in fact, Mr. Ake himself said, "It is the first mistake I have made in 17 years. My conscience is clear." Just to get that out there. He was also an airline pilot, I should say.
Hopefully he didn't make any mistakes in that job. What about miscarriages of justice in the non-libelous judicial sphere, Harry?
Well, the footballers and football people seem to get off driving offences very easily, it seems to me, in a way that perhaps a normal person wouldn't. I don't know, as a non-driver, perhaps people are getting away with these things all the time. I mean, remember Ozil doing 97 miles an hour on a motorway, avoided a driving ban by claiming he got confused by the difference between kilometres and miles. Tony Pulis avoided a driving ban in 2012 after he was caught doing 96 miles an hour in a 60 mile an hour zone. He was manager of Stoke City at the time, and his lawyer argued that a driving ban could result in him losing his job and Stoke City being relegated, thus having a negative effect on the local economy of the Potteries. And then Robbie Savage avoided a driving ban after being caught travelling at 99 miles an hour. And he was leaving an Alan Shearer charity gala in 2015. And he avoided the driving ban because his lawyer argued that he couldn't share public transport with fans who hated him. And he said his Bentley is a safe haven for him. And he was fined £600, which is the maximum penalty for his offence is £2,500. He was just fined £600, despite the fact that in his defence, the lawyer had mentioned the fact that his Bentley cost £230,000. So you'd think they'd just taken the maximum off him. I would, anyway. But there you are. So, yeah, so Robbie Savage, not banned from driving because people don't like him.
Remember, there's also George Graham made a very big deal of defending Tony, or sort of standing by Tony Adams after he got jailed for drunk driving when Adams had crashed his car into a wall, I think. And I remember from the time George Graham made it out like he's some kind of hero, you know, we'll be waiting to meet him when he comes out, all this kind of stuff. But I mean, Adams could have killed someone. You know, I mean, I don't know if he got off lightly in terms of his sentence, but he certainly indulged by Arsenal at the time.
Goalkeeper and occasional author Albert Camus wrote, "All that I know most surely about morality and obligations I owe to football." So who have been football's most moral and or principled types?
Well, weirdly, and this is not a person you'd necessarily come up with if you first thought about moral footballers, Paolo Di Canio. Everton-West Ham game in 2000. West Ham had just equalised. It was near the end of the game. And the Everton goalkeeper, Paul Gerrard, was down, but the play was going on. The referee hadn't stopped play. Cross comes over to Di Canio, could have potentially scored, but instead he caught the ball. So play would have to be stopped so that Gerrard could get treatment. And the game ended 1-1. West Ham was struggling at the time. And Harry Redknapp, who's the West Ham manager, was apparently fuming afterwards. I don't know what Di Canio was thinking. Maybe he was just thinking, you know, what would his hero Mussolini have done in the same circumstance? Invaded Abyssinia, possibly.
Harry, who has struck you as a moral footballer?
I think I've mentioned him practically on every podcast. Stan Cullis, the old Wolverhampton manager and Wolves player. When he was a player, he refused to commit professional fouls. And I think once, it might have been an incident involving Joe Mercer, or certainly Joe Mercer was playing, maybe for Arsenal. He could have brought the player down as they ran through on goal, but he didn't, and the opposition player scored. And I think it either cost Wolves an FA Cup final place or the league title. Also, when he, as a player, went for England, he was the only one of the England team who refused to give the Nazi salute in Berlin. And he wouldn't swear. He didn't swear. So the players were always amused because in his dressing room, half-time dressing room rants, he said flipping and flopping all the time. So they have this sort of rather strange, sort of like a rant in a BBC children's TV programme with a flipping and flopping. You know, he was a very strong moral man. I mean, John Arlott called him football's passionate Puritan.
Didn't Stan Cullis learn Esperanto? Have I imagined
he did
that?
Learn Esperanto. Yeah. Yeah, that was another thing because he thought that it would bring the people of the world together. You know, that was another idea, sort of showing his moral sense. I did actually, once I was in Iceland and I passed the offices of the Icelandic Esperanto Society, and I thought, I wonder how many members they have.
And have they heard of Stan Cullis?
Well, probably. I imagine he would have been one of the few people they could communicate with.
I wonder if he learned to swear in Esperanto so he could get out of his system just by saying it in a different language.
He knew the Esperanto for flipping, flopping, ruddy, blooming.
Yes, It's time for the part of the podcast where we each choose a record from that wonderful website, 45football.com. Andy, what have you picked this time?
Well, this is Allez Sochaux by the slightly strangely named Pacemakers group, Pacemaker apostrophe S group. Sochaux got to the semi-finals of the UEFA Cup this year, where they lost to AZ of Holland, who then beaten by Ipswich in the final. Ipswich's run in the UEFA Cup led to a headline I remember seeing in France Football after they'd beaten St Etienne 4-1 away, which was Ipswich, the Ajax of modern times. Which I used to throw in. Some of them have accompanied him. They're based in a town called Montbéliard, which is the home city of Peugeot, and they're founded by a member of the Peugeot family, who are the regular sponsors. So it's a bit like a sort of like Philips with PSV, but considerably less successful. They won the league twice and the cup once in the 30s, but only one trophy since, which is a French Cup in 2007. So this record is marking, would have been until recently, the second best season since the 30s, when they're only a game away from getting to the UEFA Cup final.
Harry, what have you gone for this time?
Well, on the last podcast, we talked about notable referees. I mentioned Ken Aston, the British referee who was in charge of the famous Battle of Santiago. And so, belatedly, I found El Rock del Mundial by the Ramblers, which was the first ever official World Cup song, which was for the 1962 World Cup in Chile. It's a sort of groovy R&B sound with a vague Gene Vincent vocals. And it was part of a Chilean movement called the Nueva Ola, New Wave. And I believe that it was the first rock and roll hit in Chile, spawned a lot of copycats like Peter Rock and Buddy Richards, fantastic name, who came to dominate the Chilean charts with their rock and roll. And so this record was responsible for that.
My own choice this time, the example on 45football.com has a sticker on it saying factory sample, not for sale. So I don't know if this ever saw the light of day, because it maybe is a bit too terrifying. But on a theme of recent podcasts, it is by Rod Hull and Emu and the Bristol Rovers team. And it's Bristol Rovers all the way, commemorating their promotion to Division 2 in 1974. So welcome back to the podcast, Rod Hull. Singing Bristol Rovers.
Try to watch the match. You mustn't call out things like that in the middle of a match. He's an emu and he's dressed in blue and white. And he dreams of Bristol Rovers day and night. Down at Eastville you can find him with the Rovers fans behind him. And they're singing out this song with all their might. Come on, Bristol Rovers!
Singing Bristol Rovers all the way.
All the way! Singing Bristol Rovers!
Singing Bristol Rovers, singing Bristol Rovers, singing Bristol Rovers all the way.
Each month on the When Saturday Comes podcast, I have a quick chat with someone from a club fanzine or podcast in a mirror of the way in which WSC once acted as a pivot for this country's vibrant zine movement. This time, I was joined by Kaz May from Gascast, an online Bristol Rovers supporters community.
Gascast podcast is our Bristol Rovers podcast that we have for fans. So it's fans talking about the games, giving our perspective on it. And I wasn't there from when it first started out, but I remember when the lads that I do it with now when they first brought it around. And I thought it was such a great idea because we didn't have anything like that at the club. And I think every club needs something like that. We sort of do match analysis. We do vlogs, sort of reaction vlogs on YouTube. We do interviews with players, so sort of like exclusive interviews. We do interviews with ex-players. We do all sorts that the club can't really offer. So it's a bit of extra content for Gazette. When the lads first did it, I thought it was great. And I've always supported it. And then they did an interview with one of our old managers, Daryl Clark, and it was brilliant. And I just thought in my mind, because I work in a editor role at my normal day job, I had that editor's hat on, and I asked the lads if I could cut together a video using the podcast they recorded. And so we did that, and it got a really good response. So then the lad said to me, do you want to be part of Gascast podcast? And I sort of said, yeah, that's great. And I've been on it for almost a year now. And yeah, I love it. Absolutely love it. Being part of it is really rewarding, and giving fans that content that they deserve is really, really good.
Mm. And you do your own blog as well, Step on the Gas. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so this is all fairly new. I've always enjoyed writing. When I was a kid, I used to always just write my thoughts down. And I always find Twitter is good for that, but then there's not enough characters to be able to say everything you want to say. So I thought in my mind, I was like, well, why don't I just start up a blog, and then if people are interested, they're interested. If not, then fine. But it's got a really good response, actually. I've only done about 4 or 5 so far, so it is all very new. But it's basically my experience as a fan, as a female fan. It's more my experience of going to watch the games and my perspective rather than a technical analysis of the match. So it's a bit more personal. And I found a lot of people find that they relate to what I'm saying. And hopefully once things are normal again, I could start writing about away days and what I did and how I found it and what it was like. And people can use that to sort of know what to expect when they go to away days. So that's kind of why I started it off.
And what about your life as a fan then? Why did you become a Gas head? What were your first games like? What do you remember of that?
It's quite controversial for me, really, because I've got parents that support rival clubs. So I've got dad who's Bristol City, my brother's at Bristol City, and then my mum that's Bristol Rovers. So as a kid, I had the choice growing up, and I did go to both. My dad took me to Bristol City first, and I didn't enjoy it. It just wasn't, I don't know if I was too young, but there was just something about going to Ashton Gate which just didn't appeal to me. But I was willing to give football another chance. So when Bristol Rovers got to the JPT final, I know this is a bit glory supporter-ish, but got to the JPT final at the Millennium Stadium, and I asked my mum if I could go. And she was really surprised because I hated football as a kid. Like growing up, I would hate when we'd watch it at home as a family, and I'd hate when my dad had it on the radio. I just something in my mind decided I wanted to go to Millennium Stadium with mum. And maybe it was a mum-daughter sort of bond thing that I wanted. But when I got there, I was just so overwhelmed by the fans, like how amazing they were, the atmosphere. I felt like I was an adult, even though I was only 12 years old, but I felt like I was included with all the adults, and they made me feel really welcome. And we lost the game, but even after that, I was hooked, and I wanted to go to the next one. And that same season we ended up winning the playoff final at Wembley. So I got quite a good first season as a Gashead, and since then it's been no looking back. I'm fully obsessed with the club, to be honest.
And let's be honest, the nicknames are better. Pirates, Gashead's better than Robins, and the colours are better. Having a quarter shirt, there aren't many clubs that have the shirt that you have.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I just love everything about Rovers compared to City. I mean, I like the fact that we're the weaker side in the City. I like the fact that we're not too corporate. I like the fact we've got terracing in our stadium. I like it that we've got, like, you know, our stadium's rubbish. It's not a fancy stadium by any means, not even got a roof on the away end. It just feels like a real, like, community feel at the club. The whole Gasheads, I like that nickname because we used to have a stadium that was next to Gasworks, so that came about years ago. And like you said, the quarters are unique. There's something as a kid that swayed me towards Bristol Rovers, and you could see it wasn't a mistake on my part because I'm still going strong.
In the city of Bristol, do each of you Rovers fans and City fans have stereotypes about the other. So you sort of let us in a bit there, that they're the more corporate club now and they've got a bit of money behind them in their all-seater stadium. Do they have a stereotype about Rovers fans?
Yeah, tin pot, they call us, which is fair enough. If you can't provide a roof for your away fans, then yeah, fair enough. They laugh at us. They say that we've got tents in our stadium, fair, because the roof on one of the stands is just like a marquee. So yeah, they laugh at us, and rightly so. But to be honest, it doesn't faze any of us because we'd much rather support our local side, North Bristol. And yeah, we wouldn't really change it for the world, to be honest.
Tell me about the best of times and the worst of times for you. I'm guessing best of times might have been that playoff victory. But
I've been lucky enough to see three promotions since I was 12 years old. I'm 26 now, so that's not that many years, and I've actually been quite fortunate to see it. But the worst time for me would be dropping out of the league after 94 years. I mean, that was an awful thing to go through. Yeah, we dropped into the conference. It was the final day of the season, and all we needed to do was draw. So you think, 11 men behind the ball, how hard can it be? But it just didn't go our way. We lost 1-0, and the silence in that ground when we got relegated, it was like you couldn't hear a pin drop the second that final whistle went. Everyone was just in so much disbelief. And then shortly after that, the atmosphere just then turned toxic. People started running over to the board, trying to get into the box. People started running over to the opposition fans, and there was fights. There was police running on the pitch. It was just awful. And for me, I didn't leave that ground, I don't think, for about 3 hours after, because I was just in so much shock. And then it was kind of a bit of a got home, just went straight to bed, didn't know what to think. That was definitely the worst moment for me, because yeah, dropping out of the league is massive for a club of Bristol Rovers' size. But the conference was the best season ever, because we were winning every week, we were selling out every week. We got to go to these grounds that you'd never normally go to. So we went to like Telford, Dover, Nuneaton, and now that I look back at it and we went up at the first attempt, it was a good laugh and it was a great season. But had we not gone up at the first attempt, then yeah, we could have ended up getting stuck and it would be very, very bad times for us. But luckily, Daryl Clark got us up, back-to-back promotions then. And the best moment for me has got to be promotion to League One after we dropped down. We went back up and then we got promoted again. And yeah, we got promoted in the best way possible, which was in the 92nd minute winner. And it was at home on a sunny day. And then after that, we all went down Gloucester Road. The police did very well because they closed off the roads for us. So they stopped cars coming down the road and we just had a massive street party down Gloucester Road. Yeah, that is probably one of the best days of my life. Actually, it is the best day of my life. I'm not married or anything like that, or our kids, but yes, but definitely the best day of my life. It was absolutely incredible.
That conference season led to me seeing Bristol Rovers away at Gateshead. I was in the away end because I met some men on the internet. That's what you do now, isn't it? And, yeah. And that was the first time I'd experienced the singing of Goodnight Irene from among your own fans. What a beautiful anthem. It's very, very tender thing for football fans to be singing a song like that, isn't it? It really struck me.
Yeah, I tell you what, I had a dream about that last night. it's definitely, like we were saying earlier about the uniqueness of the club. Goodnight Irene definitely is another one. No other club sings it. That's ours. And yeah, it is. Once everyone is singing it together, it can be really bellowing, and it can under the roof of the Thatcher's End, which is at our home ground, it's the most beautiful sound for me. Another time I remember it, one of the best times was at Fratton Park, because they've got quite like a low roof as well, and the atmosphere, everyone singing it all together, you know, you're talking thousands of gas heads singing the same song. Yeah, it really is beautiful.
Bring us to today then. An awful lot of managers and caretaker managers in the last couple of years
yeah,
with Rovers, and Joey Barton. Your thoughts on him?
I'll tell you what, like when Joey Barton's name first came about, I was on the fence. I wasn't sure what to think, because obviously he's got a colourful past, he's got a bad reputation, but I do put the safety of this club first. By safety, I mean avoiding the relegation zone. And I just think he is the right man to do it. He's the right man to save us. And I understand people's concerns. There are a lot of fans that have turned around and said they won't get a season ticket whilst he's in charge. They won't go to a game whilst he's in charge. A lot of people have taken themselves off social media because they can't stand seeing fellow Gasheads praising him. So I get it. It's a tough one. But for me, I put the performances on the pitch and where this club stands in the league before someone's reputation that may come in. I know that's a funny way of looking at it, but to be honest, if he saves us, then everything else for me is secondary. He may well go to prison in June still, which is obviously not great. I hope there's something in the contract to sort that out if he does. But yeah, for me, if he keeps us up, then happy days. That's all I really care about. And I've really warmed to him. He gets it. He's passionate, which is why he has the reputation he does on the football pitch. Obviously, everyone knows that famous QPR Man City game. But yeah, it's his passion, I think, which will save us. And that's the most important to me, to be honest.
And now across the land, we're all dreaming of being back in the ground. And this dream has gone on for far too long now, I think. What are you looking forward to most about match day? A Saturday 3 p.m. in, let's hope, August.
To be honest, probably not even the game itself. But that's life of being a Bristol Rovers fan, unfortunately. But no, it's seeing everyone. It's the community. Football is far more than just 90 minutes. And a lot of people who don't support football don't understand that. It's everything. It's around the game. It's the mood it puts you in. And it's seeing all the friends that you've met through supporting your club. And so many of my close friends, there's too many to count, that I've met through supporting Bristol Rovers or even just being a football fan. Yeah, I just can't wait to see them all in one place again. Sod this rule of six. Let's all go to a game together. I don't care where that game is on the 7th of August. If it's in the grottiest place in England, I am going. I am going, and I'm going with my friends that I've met through this football club, and we're going to watch that game together. That's what I'm most looking forward to.
You've been listening to the When Saturday Comes podcast, produced and edited by me, Daniel Gray. Please have a think about supporting us on patreon.com/whensaturdaycomes, which will give you access to bonus podcast material and other goodies. And please do join me, Andy and Harry again next time for more vital, topical and half-decent chatter.